SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, in association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, is pleased to present another in the SNI Digital series on controversies in spine surgery, three 40-minute lectures with discussion. They're given on the topic of pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery by Nancy Epstein. Nancy is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. She's been in the practice of spine surgery for 40 years. And has a bibliography that's one of the most extensive in the field. A series of lectures on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior spine, cervical spine surgery are focused on how to choose the correct approaches to lesions in the cervical spine with attention to the K-line. Part one is on the anatomy, imaging, clinical presentations, of cervical spine neurologic disease and one-level ACDF, 40 minutes. Part two is on approach to two-level or more anterior cervical spine lesions, also 40 minutes. And part three is on approaches to posterior cervical spine lesions, also 40 minutes. And this part three lectures is on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery, is on the K-line and choosing posterior approaches to cervical spine lesions. It's also a 40-minute lecture and discussion.
Should be looking at these cases saying, what should be done? This patient is paraplegic. This is a problem. This should be dealt with.
Why don't we take a break here for just a minute, because you're going to get into posterior, right?
Yes.
And we'll just you and I will talk for a couple of minutes and we'll start again. I'm going to leave it run. So I thought that was excellent. It really a lot of good tips and clues there. And I may divide it into, it took us about an hour for that, or 55 minutes. It was good. I think we will divide it into anterior and posterior, but I also may do two things. I want your input on that. Is the first part was the introduction, which was the anatomy, the imaging, and the neurologic presentation.
Right.
We could also have it as a four-part series. Then the choice is, do we use the do the shunt separately or not? If you have it as a separate talk, I'm thinking out loud here, I'm not sure it's as meaningful as if you attach it to the subsequent anterior series. Mm-hmm. What do you think about all those ideas?
I think you could do the anterior and up to anterior discectomy infusion. I think you could segment out the anterior corpectomy infusion and then do that as a segment and then do the posterior as another segment. And just say this is, you know, three part series, maybe this is part A, B, and C.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think the images that are shown with the review of the CAT scan and MR are sort of critical to the anterior and posterior surgical decision-making processes.
So we break the anterior cervical after it's a simple one level.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I think we can find a break there.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's so we need the anatomy with a simple anterior cervical discectomy infusion, then more complex anterior operations and posterior operations.
Right. Right.
Okay. I think that's good.
Yeah. You know, see how you feel about that. The other thing I was telling you too, is I have also separate lectures on anterior corpectomy infusions and posterior cervical. So you could see, we could see what you think of those just as maybe supplemental, more detailed in-depth views.
We could do those. We could go through what you're going to do, and it's up to you, because you're the one who's doing this, is we could record it, but you could use them as a later, two later entries in the series, more approaching more complex cases.
Okay,
Something
good.
like
Because I
that.
have them.
Yeah.
And I've worked on them already.
So it's up to you how you want to do it, but I we're doing is putting together a library. It's terrific. So this is 10 recorded 10, but there are but no, I think we're doing pretty good. That's good. Okay, you want to go ahead with that? You can just go on and say about posterior cervical surgery. You might introduce it.
Next, we're going to look at posterior cervical surgery. How do you make a decision for a posterior cervical operation? And one of the main points that I'm going to emphasize here is, and we're going to integrate what's called the K-line as to how we make this decision. If you have the opportunity to do a posterior cervical procedure rather than an anterior or a 360, the morbidity of that choice is, you're going to have an easier postoperative course, easier postoperative outcome, and reduced morbidity, fewer adverse events associated with it. So I think it's something that you have to look at very, very carefully. Again, this is sort of your typical posterior cervical procedure. You've got the patient in a three-pin head holder. By the way, I always use a three-pin head holder. Do not use the face masks. You can get pressure in the eyes. The actual position of the neck can change. You can end up with jugular compression, et cetera. Here you have absolute control. You can get a cervical X-ray to make sure the patient is completely neutral. And here you can see we've marked out the posterior cervical incision that we're going to use. By the way, SEP, somatosensory evoked potential, motor evoked potential, and EMG monitoring is important. By taping the shoulders, watch out, you can actually incur a plexus injury, brachial plexus injury. So you want to make sure that you have your monitoring going while you're positioning the patient for cervical surgery, much less posterior cervical surgery, because it can save you from creating a disaster from the get-go, much less hyperextending the patient or hypoflexing the patient.
Terrific points.
It's best to choose a posterior operation if you can for a cervical disc. As I said, I spoke to a young colleague the other day, and he said, I was never trained to do a laminophoremonotomy. I'd like to learn how to do those. I was trained to do an ACDF, so that's what I do. And I said, but you're talking about doing a C6-7, C7-T1 ACDF on a pretty large patient. Don't you think the morbidity would be much reduced and the patient would be happier if you did a laminophoremonotomy at those levels instead? We have in the SNI Digital series an entire lecture devoted to laminophoremonotomies that Jim and I discussed. So we will just going to refer you to that, but just as a refresher, this is a lateral, an image here of a lateral spur and lateral and foraminal root compression, no cord compression here. Here is your laminophoremonotomy with your medial facetectomy for laminotomy. By the way, watch out, there's your vertebral artery out there. You don't want to get into that. So you have to keep your wits about you when you're doing these procedures. You have root exposed, you often have very little cord exposed. That's why the morbidity of these procedures is minimal. And typically, you do not have to fuse these patients. Here is a figurative diagram of a disc herniation. If it goes too medially, you might want to go anteriorly, but if it's very foraminal, as in this case, you don't. And this is what that foraminotomy, it translates to a window procedure that you may be performing. By the way, if you're doing this at C71, very likely you're going to have to do an accompanying fusion at that level.
You're going to have to do a what at that level?
A fusion at
Oh, fusion.
C71, if you're
Okay.
doing a foraminotomy at
Okay.
C71 because
Here.
of the cervical thoracic junction. But again, here's an MR of a lateral and foraminal disc where you could approach it from behind. You can use your Penfield elevators to identify that nerve root because the arms are typically down by the side. The nerve root in your image are typically coming down. In the old days, we used to put the patient in a sitting position with their arms upward, so the root would go up, but now it goes down. So you have to use a Penfield elevator to get into the axilla or the armpit of that nerve. And then use your downbiting curette. You can use a downbiting curette to remove spurs and/or osteophytes that may go laterally and foraminally. And again, watch out if you're concerned about a vertebral artery problem here too. But we're going to go back to our discussion of the K-line and how you use a K-line. For posterior cervical surgery, you want that positive K-line. Okay, that means that mid between C2 and the posterior elements and C7 and the posterior elements, you draw a vertical line. Your pathology is anterior to that line. Again, your options are going to be multiple. You can have anterior, posterior, or 360 surgery. Use your posterior surgical options if you can. This is going to be exclusive of the negative K-line, which we have previously discussed. So the positive K-line means your disease is anterior to the K-line, your surgical options, anterior, posterior, 360 surgery. Best to choose posterior surgery because of the more limited morbidity associated with these procedures. So here's an example of a patient who has a positive K-line, and you may choose to do a laminectomy and a posterior fusion for discs, burrs, stenosis, or spondylosis. And here you can see your pathology is anterior to that K-line. Okay, so it's pretty simple to remember, pretty simple to measure. And again, you know, your posterior surgical operations are going to limit the risk of a CSF leak, much less the other risks and complications. You know, your posterior cervical procedures, your dysphagia, unless the patient's intubated for a very long time, is going to be much, much less. Risk of your CSF leaks, much less. Risk of a carotid injury, an internal jugular injury, recurrent laryngeal injury, a phrenic nerve injury. I mean, all of the list goes on and on. You can choose to do a laminectomy to decompress the cord. The cord is going to migrate posteriorly as long as you have, in this case, you have a good cervical lordosis. And here's your laminectomy with posterior migration of the cord into that space that you've created. Ventral kyphosis, contraindication relatively for performing posterior cervical surgery. Sometimes you may have surgeons who may do an anterior discectomy graft above and below the pathology to throw the patient into some degree of lordosis to do a posterior procedure. But here again, a positive K-line. Here's your X-ray, and it's showing you, I'm showing you the stenosis here. My uncle, the neuroradiologist, he used to terrorize me as a 15-year-old when I would visit him over vacation in his radiology office where he was the chair, would say, okay, Epstein, tell me about spinal stenosis. And I would have to say, if you measure from the mid-vertebral body to the posterior interlaminar line, and that arrow is shorter than the measurement front to back of your vertebral body, most likely you have spinal stenosis on a 6-foot lateral film.
Interesting. Okay. Never heard that before.
And here again is an MR image of a stenotic spinal canal. And remember, we didn't have MRIs until, you know, the 80s, essentially. Before then, it was myelograms. We didn't even have CAT scans yet until like 1976, where as a first year resident neurosurgery, we were running around with Polaroids of CT images because we had only two machines in all of New York City. But here you can see, look at the MR, cord compressed opposite these levels, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, and 6, 7, straightened lordosis and stenosis. Okay, lordosis here, straightened. But you can see how, if you remove the vertebral bodies here, you can, with a straightened lordosis in some instances, get away with a posterior operation. Or if you do an anterior discectomy infusion with a lordotic graft above or below this, sometimes you can reverse the lordosis, put them into more lordosis, and get away with a posterior operation. So again, I'm going to show you just multiple examples of an MR cervical lordosis, really a hyperlordotic curvature. Look at the lordosis here, C2, C3, C4, 5, and 6. Look at the ventral compression. Look at the dorsal compression. You actually have shingling of the lamina. Instead of the lamina being sort of like this, you have the shingled lamina like that, right beneath it. But if you have a good lordotic curvature, as in both of these images, and in this third image of a myelogram CAT scan, okay, you remove the lamina from behind, that cord will migrate posteriorly like a rubber band, and then you confuse the patient because you have to maintain the lordosis. Here's another example. We've already gone through this previously in a previous lecture, C2, C3, C4. This is not disc disease. This is ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament going from C4, 5, all the way behind 5, C5, 6, behind 6, and all the way down to 6, 7. There may be sometimes accompanying disc with that, But if you take away all the bone back here, you may allow that cord to migrate posteriorly because you do have that good cervical lordotic curvature. And then this is an example of spondylosis where actually you have a high signal in the cord. But again, that good lordotic curvature is going to save you. Other examples here, again, curvature, good cervical lordosis, here seen on an MR, here seen on a CT scan. That's actually the same patient. Look in the CAT scan, see the shingled lamina. One, the leading edge of the lamina below is anterior to the level above, same thing over here. And it's just like, you know, your Venetian blinds, one goes right in front of the other, and the leading edge inferiorly compresses your cord. Another example of shingled lamina here, this is C2, and this is C3, 4, and 5, and the lamina are shingled under each other here, C2, C3, here C4, 5, 6, and 7, they're all shingled underneath here. If you remove 5, 6, and 7 with a laminectomy, it allows your cord to come down, and then you can do a posterior fusion to preserve that anatomical alignment and get away with it. Here on an axial image, I'm showing you that you're seeing the shingled lamina. It means you see actually two lamina on the same axial image, and you're seeing it in this picture and maybe a little bit better in this picture. So you need to be able to read your own scans. Do not just rely on the radiologists. You need to know how to discern where the pathology is and how you're going to go about dealing with it. When you do the laminectomy, this is actually what you're doing. You're removing the lamina and the spinous process. You're preserving the facets, or you may be doing a medial facetectomy for eminotomy if you have spurs. You're going to have that patient when you do these operations in the prone position. Usually, we would do nasotracheal awake intubations to make sure we're not flexing or extending the neck. You numb up the nose and the throat. You snake your way down with the nasotracheal tube and the fiber optic device. You intubate them then safely, and you get your baseline intraoperative monitoring. Motor evokes with them supine before you even turn them over. You can give them a short dose of propofol and get a motor evoke so you have a good preoperative baseline. You do not want to get your baseline after you are already positioned for surgery because you may have already compromised that patient. You may have already damaged that patient. Same thing for SEPs and your EMGs, obviously. EMGs, you're just going to get activity. So here's your figurative diagram of your laminectomy. Here's your laminectomy, and here's the bone that's been removed. Again, you've removed that bone. This is actually a patient with OPLL, and look at the mass of OPLL that's there, but the cord on this image could be sitting here, especially if you did an MRI. And here, this is a three-dimensional CT following a laminectomy where you just have C2 and C7 are still in place, but all the other bones have been removed. So your cord on the MRI is going to have migrated posteriorly into the space that you've created in that patient with a lordosis. Just some figurative images of you're doing your cervical laminectomy. Here is C2. Down here is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then here may be T1. Downbiting curettes, you do your medial facetectomy for eminotomy, and you can use your downbiting curettes after you used a nerve hook and a Penfield elevator to make sure that you are not going in and inadvertently taking out the anterior motor nerve root. Again, that sometimes is not ensleeved in the dura, and you can mistake it for a disc. So this is the dissection that you're going to want to be doing, and you can remove your spurs with your downbiting curettes by doing this. You can do your foraminotomies. You don't necessarily have to do full facetectomies. Obviously, that's going to further destabilize the patient. Too much of the time, surgeons are actually automatically taking out the facet joints, destabilizing the patient. But this is what it actually can look like. So you've done a laminectomy. This is actually the dura, multiple levels, medial facetectomy, foraminotomy. Here at one level, you're doing a more extensive foraminal dissection. Here is a nerve root exiting inferiorly and downward because, again, those arms are positioned down next to the body in that prone position. And here is a Penfield elevator very gently dissecting, exposing the axilla or armpit of that nerve root. And this is where you're going to then introduce your downbiting curettes, very small 2, 3 millimeter curettes. And again, every movement you do is away from the patient. You never use that curette towards the patient. That's how you're going to damage the cord inadvertently or get a CSF leak. Okay.
You see, you mentioned the anterior motor rod sometimes is separate. Where would you see it in that picture?
Okay. Well, you may see this. This could be just your isolated posterior sensory root that is in con you know that is ensconced in the dura, has a dural sleeve, but you may see just ventral to it, like running here,
Yeah.
something white, but the white would be coming down like that. That could be your anterior motor nerve root that is not intradural, but it can look very much like sometimes your disc fragments. That's why you have to listen to your EMGs very carefully, use that Penfield elevator, use your operating microscope to make sure you have exposed disc and you have not exposed or decided to take out that anterior motor root.
Okay, terrific.
Okay, but it can be very tricky to do that. Here's just an example where this is a preoperative MR. You've got a tight spinal canal. You've done a laminectomy here. Here's a post-op CT scan. That's a pre-op MR. Post-op CT, here's C2. You're taking out the lamina of 3, 4, 5, 6. And here's an intact lamina of 7. And here on the CAT scan, you're just seeing some air, et cetera. That's because this is where your operative wound was. You're not seeing any detail of the cord, though, are you? Okay. Here's your post-operative MR. Same patient, same time, early post-op. But here's your cord. Here's your cord pre-op compressed from front to back, you know, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. Kind of, they used to call it like the washboard. Not that I would know what that is, but anyway. But here is your cord now decompressed. You see CSF anteriorly and no CSF posteriorly here, no CSF anteriorly here. Now you see spinal fluid anteriorly. Now you see spinal fluid posteriorly. The cord has migrated. This is your posterior decompression. Okay, that's what you want to see.
If you take an image, that same image as your last image, MR image, 3 months later, is it different or does it look like that?
Okay, let me just get through. It should look like this or even better. Now, if you have had a very compressed spinal cord originally, and you have, let's say, just post-op edema in the cord, you may see more cord atrophy or myelomalacia, which would show you even more spinal fluid around the cord 3 months later, 6 months later, et cetera. Okay. The beauty also of doing your post-op studies is, let's say you had one level where you had much more anterior compression. If there is on this post-op CT, much less MR, one level where you see residual significant anterior cord compression, be it a disc, a spur, an osteophyte, whatever, you could then go back and decompress that spinal cord anteriorly at that specific level. But that's why post-op studies are important. You want to know what you've done. You want to know what disease may be remaining behind. You want to make sure you don't have a post-operative hematoma. Okay. And doing sequential studies is also important, especially, you know, in terms of your MRI scans, because if anything neurologically changes or gets worse, you need to study this. I see this again and again in looking at medical legal cases. It's almost like they're shoving everything under the rug. The last thing they want to do is a post-op study to document where the problem is. It might say you have to go back. It might say, you know, maybe you only did a laminectomy at 2 levels and you need to do another 3 or 4 levels to decompress the cord.
Well, when I look at the film and I go back to your measuring that the space there is in a spinal canal after you've decompressed them, it still looks compromised. If you look at the C6 level, there's a much wider area of CSF. It could be because of the cervical enlargement, but how do you look at that?
Well, very important on the MR, you have to look at all the medial lateral images. You have to, you know, this is just one sort of mid sagittal image. You have to go from side to side. You also have to definitely look at the axial studies to
Okay.
document that you've adequately decompressed the cord. But you're absolutely right. What can often happen, especially at the mesenteric and caudate levels, you may find, hey, I've got residual compression. I've got to go back and do that or add that to the fusion and do a laminectomy, or maybe I have to go back anteriorly. But you need to look at the entire study, not just one set image.
So you need to know at the end of surgery, yes, I've decompressed them, but this person may still have some potential for problems. I mean, you need to come away with some conclusion.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
And post, I mean, there were lots of instances where, let's say, if intraoperatively, let's say, hypothetically, you did this operation and the patient had significant intraoperative changes.
Yeah.
But then they came back and you didn't think that you had to change your operative plan, which lots of times you have to do, raise the blood pressure, stop your distraction, et cetera. You keep the OR clean, you reverse the anesthetic, but keep them intubated in the OR. You call down to MR or CAT scan or both and say, I want to come down and get a stat study. You keep all the instrumentation in the OR ready to come back. You go get your stat study. You then can call back to the OR saying, oh, it's okay. We're adequately decompressed. Or, hey, we're going to come back. We need to do something more.
Okay, good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
So here's another example where look at the multi-level, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Especially at 6, 7, you see the high signal in the cord. This does not look good. This is your MR. It's not the best picture in the world. Here is a post-operative AP C567 lateral mass screws have been placed. Here's your lateral view. Post-op screws are placed, et cetera. But most importantly, this is what you want to see in your post-op MRI. Okay, C2, C3, C4, 5, 6, 7. You've done a complete laminectomy. This is more like what we typically would see, Jim. We
Okay.
see more of a big bath of spinal fluid all around the cord. And that's what we're more happy looking at. And
Well,
again,
if you look at the other one, you've done the best you can do, but it's something you just have to keep track of. That's all.
right. And sequentially, the next week, the next month, et cetera, or the next few days. It
Yeah.
all depends on what that patient's neurological status is. The worst thing to do is like a complicated multi-level corpectomy patient that I presented. The worst thing to do is you do post-op studies, you do one operation or whatever it is, but you don't do any sequential follow-up studies, especially if that patient remains quadriplegic or has a significant deficit. You have to continue to do studies. Surveillance is critical. Decision-making is still critical. You can't just abandon the patient and just say, hey, it's everybody else's problem. I'm done.
Okay, real good.
And then posteriorly, you need to do a fusion to preserve that lordotic curvature because otherwise they'll become kyphotic and angulate forward. Lateral mass screws, you can use those C3, 4, 5, 6, C7, T1, and also at C2, it's going to be pedicle screws. So you can decide which of these you need. Sometimes when you're doing multi-level cervical laminectomy, you're going to fuse down to the T2 level to make sure you really stabilize that cervical thoracic junction. So in conclusion, when you are doing any of these cervical operations, look at your preoperative MR. I would say a preoperative CT scan is absolutely worth it. The CT scan can be smarter than you are. Make sure you learn how to read these studies yourself in addition to listening to your radiologist. I highly recommend conferring with your neuroradiologists. And I was very lucky. I still am. I have a neuroradiologist who's absolutely brilliant, and I would never operate without conferring with him and just bouncing back and forth. Do you see this? Do you see that? Do I need to repeat this? Do I need to get a better image of that? Is there a problem someplace else? Because you want to, based on these findings, do the right operation for that patient, and your patient will thank you.
Okay, that's terrific, Nancy. Really a tour de force of cervical spine surgery, pros and cons, just as you said, and really appreciate it. That's just an outstanding job.
The other thing we want to include here, I think, Jim, is just the references that people can look at.
Okay.
Neurological recovery after traumatic cervical spine injury. This is talking about when you reoperate on patients, the earlier the better, less than 24 hours. But if they have a significant deficit, you don't wait that period of time. It's like 0 to 24 hours, 6 or 12 hours. So here's in this study from Neurotrauma 2015, decompression infusion, 8 to 24 hours. At 6 months, you're going to have better ASIA grade, AIS grades. That's like ASIA grades, essentially. So suggest that patients with spinal cord injury undergo surgical studies within and decompression within 8 hours after injury, and they're going to have better outcomes. Here's another study from Burke et al. In neurosurgery. Surgery within less than 12 hours, you're going to get relative improvement in these patients. Another study from Lancet 2021, early surgery, you're going to see greater recovery versus the late operations. And they said, quote, there was a steep decline in changes in total motor score with increasing time duration the first 24 to 36 hours after the injury. And in Kui et al. 2021, early surgery less than 24 hours compared with late surgery, acute spinal cord injury, early surgery, greater recovery. Global Spine 2017, this is Wilson et al., and it included Failings, who was one of the promoters of Time is Spine. Early surgery supports improved neurological recovery among spinal cord injury patients undergoing early surgery. This is a systematic review. This was a Failing study in Global Spine 2024. Early surgery, again, overall moderate strength evidence, early surgery less than 24 for better recovery, very critical, except for those with longer. And here is Failing's article, Global Spine, Time is Spine. All spinal cord injuries, preclinical evidence suggests early limited secondary injury reduces damage to the neural tissues and improves function. Ultra early surgery, they couldn't make a comment on, but all of these factors are important in trying to get the best results.
Okay,
Okay.
terrific job. Really appreciate it. Really outstanding. Really,
Okay.
really hope you
Good.
enjoyed this presentation. Material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. At the end of this video, please fill out your evaluation of this program. And these are recorded sessions available free on snidigital.org. If you have questions, comments, or want to request CME credit, write to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. Foundation supporting these programs has, as one of its journals, a 2D internet journal with Nancy Epstein as the editor-in-chief. It is SNI, also known as Surgical Neurology International. Its web address is sni.global. The other journal is a 3D live new video journal of neurosurgery and neuroscience, interactive with discussion. It's SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, and the web address is snidigital.org. The information on both of these journals is free on the internet to everyone everywhere 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It's been published for 14 years. It's the third most widely read 2D journal in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is now seen in 106 countries in 5 months. It's a new 3D video journal. The goal of the foundation is to help people throughout the world. Also, it has a medical news network dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. These programs are sponsored by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. They're copyrighted in 2024. All rights are reserved. Thank you for watching the program. We hope you've enjoyed it.